Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Sputnik Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and NHK Japan. We will begin with Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with Professor Aviva Chomsky, author of Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration. She is the daughter of Noam Chomsky. She discusses the U.S. support for right-wing governments in Latin America, how Hugo Chavez's Venezuela provided a different path for Latin American nations to avoid neoliberalism imposed by the U.S., IMF, and the World Bank, and the U.S. demand that Latin American policies must be favorable for U.S. corporations, which in turn hurt the working classes of Latin America, the U.S. government's efforts to destroy left-wing politics within trade unions in the United States, Latin America, and around the world, the U.S.-backed overthrow of Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009, and why Biden's foreign policy in Latin America is not likely to diverge from past presidents. Sputnik Radio.
Today, a local former Coca-Cola boss is inaugurated as Ecuadorian president. A new book looks into powerful corporate elites and Washington's so-called backyard. It links U.S. coups in Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, and El Salvador to Joe Biden's caged children on the U.S.-Mexico border. Joining me now from Salem in Massachusetts is Professor Aviva Chomsky, author of Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration. Thanks so much for coming back on, Aviva. I should just say, you know, the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said he had to complain to the Biden administration because he accused them of promoting a coup ahead of the ex-California prosecutor, Vice President Kamala Harris, meeting with him. Somehow emblematic of this new book of yours, Central America's Forgotten History.
Clearly, one of the things that you see by looking at Central America's history is that the United States supports certain types of governments in Central America. Whether they were democratically elected or not has absolutely zero relevance. But if a Central American government is willing to bow down to U.S. economic demands, the United States will always support it. And if it isn't, the United States doesn't care whether it's democratically elected or not, but is very willing to overthrow it, as we've seen over and over again.
At the present day, Boris Johnson's government, Joe Biden's administration are trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela. Venezuela comes up again and again in the book of how the influence of Hugo Chavez's administration in terms of aid countering U.S. efforts towards neoliberalism. Tell me about Venezuela's role in Central America.
Not so much right now, but certainly during the Hugo Chavez period when Venezuela had a lot more money to offer, Venezuela offered Latin American countries a potential path away from the neoliberal policies being imposed by the United States and the international financial institutions by offering low-cost petroleum, setting up trade relations, offering them a kind of an escape from the debt trap that they had so long been caught in, which makes them completely subject to the United States and the international financial institutions in terms of what kinds of domestic economic policies they can impose. The United States has a very clear demand for Central America that its domestic economic policies be favorable to U.S. corporations. And that generally means that the policies are going to be unfavorable to the poor of those countries, because the very policies that U.S. corporations want are things like low wages, no taxes, no environmental regulations, no unions, police repression of any kind of protest. Oh, and access to land that is military and police aid in dispossessing peasants from their land so that U.S. corporations can have access to them. That's precisely the opposite of the kinds of policies that would be beneficial to the poor majorities in Central America.
For millions of people around the world, they can see one emblem maybe on their kitchen table of all of this, bananas.
Well, I would say bananas and coffee. Historically, bananas and coffee, starting in the 19th century, have been the primary exports of Central America, although that's diversified a lot now. And I would say that U.S. consumers also will find Central American products on their bodies. So if people who are listening to this in the United States, if you look at the labels on your clothes, probably every one of you is wearing an item of clothing that's going to say made in Honduras, made in Nicaragua, made in El Salvador.
Obviously, you mentioned trade unions. The United States, successive administrations would deny any malign influence, of course, south of the Rio Grande. How has the United States and its intelligence, military industrial complex, inserted itself in trade unionism?
So I think there's been a real transformation over the course of the 1990s and up to the present day in the U.S. trade union movement. But certainly the post-World War II U.S. labor movement, official labor movement, that AFL and later AFL-CIO after 1955, really bought into the Cold War ideology of repressing and eliminating the left within the U.S. trade union movement and supporting U.S. foreign policy to eliminate the left in trade unions around the world. And that went right hand in hand with the policies towards Latin America, towards Central America, to try to promote what they called free trade unions. And that's why the AFILD, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, was basically an anti-communist push to try to de-radicalize labor movements, and often with very high degrees of repression, including murder against trade union activists who sought the kinds of economic changes and reforms that the United States opposed. Although in Central America, when we have revolutions going on in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, and the United States is adamantly opposed to those revolutions, and AFILD plays an important role in trying to undermine those revolutions. However, I should also say that it's really, I think, during those Central American wars in the 1980s that we start seeing resistance from below within the trade union movement against the leadership.
The book has such a huge range. Obviously, anyone who voted for Trump will say NAFTA was abolished under his administration. But just skipping over, at least Trump didn't overthrow any countries directly like President Obama appears to have done in Honduras. Do you think Biden will go back to the old playbook of overthrowing countries in Central America, given he was vice president when Manuel Zelaya was removed in Honduras in 2009?
I wouldn't say that the United States directly overthrew Zelaya in Honduras, but it certainly supported the overthrow of Zelaya in Honduras. I don't actually see a very big difference between the Obama and Trump administrations or between Democratic and Republican administrations in general. What we've seen from the Biden administration so far is an absolute commitment to the same kind of pro-foreign investment economic model, and also to supporting the militaries and police in those countries on the pretext of trying to slow and stop migration. So there's sort of a humanitarian veneer to both of these. That is, Biden, like every U.S. president, claims that this is a model that's going to help eliminate poverty in Central America. It's been followed for 500 years, and it hasn't eliminated poverty yet. And the militarization is kind of covered up by trying to get us to focus on what they call the border crisis. So there is a crisis at the border, but the border crisis is not going to be stopped by moving the repression into Central America itself.
Professor Aviva Chomsky, thank you.
That interview was by Afshin Ratansi from his program called Going Underground, heard on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. An economic commission for Latin America released a report that the region is experiencing the highest levels of extreme poverty in 20 years. In 2020, the number of people forced to move within their own country because of climate disasters reached at least 30 million, the highest level in a decade. China has donated 12,000 solar electrical systems to Cuba to help combat climate change. Reuters conducted a poll that shows that the majority of Republican voters in the U.S. believe that Biden stole the election from Trump and that the January 6th failed revolution was led by violent left-wing protesters to make Trump look bad. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said that any renewed attacks by Hamas would be met with a more powerful response. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, ECLAC, ECLAC, has revealed in a report entitled Social Panorama of Latin America that the region registered the highest indicators of extreme poverty in 20 years in 2020. According to the research, last year Latin America accumulated 78 million people in extreme poverty, a figure never reached in the 20th century before. ECLAC states that the increase is largely due to the impact that COVID-19 has had on the economy. These figures point to 12.5% of the population in Latin America living in extreme poverty, an index only surpassed in 1999 when the total rose to 12.8%. ECLAC confirms that, quote, to curb the spread of the coronavirus, governments have adopted quarantine measures, therefore entire sectors of the economy have seen their activity halted or temporarily reduced to zero, depending on the rigidity of the measures adopted. At the same time, quote, the contraction of economic activity generated by the pandemic and the consequent job losses and reduction of labor income in the low-income strata, as well as process of downward mobility in the middle-income strata. The number of new people forced to move from within their own countries by climate disasters rose to the highest in at least a decade in 2020, more than three times those displaced due to conflict and violence. People who migrated domestically due to extreme weather events rose to 30.7 million, or 75% of those uprooted within their borders. This according to a report by the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. A record 55 million people in total had been forced to move at the end of the year 2020, with the number of climate migrants likely to be significantly underestimated due to incomplete data. Climate change is causing more frequent and intense weather events. Contrary to fears of mass cross-border migration, many of the displacements are small-scale and localized, this according to the report, costing economies about $25.5 billion globally in 2020. Densely populated countries like China, India, the Philippines, and Bangladesh were hit by intense cyclones, monsoon rains, and floods, while 1.7 million people were displaced within the U.S. during the most active Atlantic hurricane season on record. The report said that these all-time high numbers were recorded even as the spread of coronavirus hampered humanitarian organizations' ability to register and assist displaced people.
Some 5,000 solar panel systems will soon be donated to Cuba as part of the Chinese government Belt and Road Initiative to combat climate change. According to information published on the Cuban Ministry of Foreign Trade website, the project is part of the South-South cooperation proposed by President Xi Jinping in 2013 under the idea of joint construction of global scope for development. The note refers that in November 2018, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel verified the importance of this proposal during his visit to the Asian country based on the signing of a memorandum of understanding between both governments for cooperation. The identification of possibilities of support and financing for projects, the strengthening of infrastructures, and the transfer of technology and research are among the main interests of the Belt and Road Initiative. China and Cuba established diplomatic relations in 1960, and through the years, both nations have accompanied each other in the fight against unilateralism and the condemnation of the use of force and violation of international law.
A new poll shows that 53% of Republican Party voters say Donald Trump, not Joe Biden, is currently the true president of the United States. According to a recent Ipsos Reuters poll of over 2,000 U.S. adults, 56% of Republicans still believe the November presidential election was rigged or the result of illegal voting. The poll also shows that 87% of Republicans think it is important for the government to place new limits on voting to protect future election fraud. While a 55% majority overall said Biden's victory was, quote, legitimate and accurate, one quarter of Americans from all political affiliations say they think it was the result of illegal ballot counting or election rigging. On January the 6th, a group of mobs supporting Trump launched a deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol, briefly disrupting the certification of the election results. The riot left five people dead, including a law enforcement officer. It prompted a historic second impeachment trial, but the Republican-controlled Senate acquitted Trump. 54% of the recent polls say they think the Capitol riot, quote, was led by violent left-wing protesters trying to make Trump look bad. The former president is still at large somewhere near Miami in the U.S. state of Florida. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened, quote, a very powerful response if Hamas breaks a ceasefire that ended a deadly 11-day bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu made the comment in West Jerusalem on Tuesday during a joint press conference with American Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, who traveled to the region to bolster the initial ceasefire agreement. The Israeli Prime Minister thanked the United States for, quote, supporting Israel's right to self-defense firmly during the violence in which Israeli airstrikes killed at least 248 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza. At least 12 Israelis, including two children, were killed by rockets fired by Hamas and other armed groups from Gaza during the fighting, which began on May the 10th and saw intercommunal violence break out across Israel, as well as several Palestinians killed in protests in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu added, "We too will give meaning to our commitment to our self-defense. If Hamas breaks the calm and attacks Israel, our response will be very powerful." Blinken, in turn, said the U.S. would work to assure the international aid to rebuild Gaza would not benefit Hamas. Quote, "We will work closely with our partners, with all, to ensure that Hamas does not benefit from the reconstruction assistance." The Secretary of State also defended against criticism that the administration of President Joe Biden should have taken a more public and firm line with Israel earlier on in the fighting by crediting Washington's, quote, intense behind-the-scenes diplomacy in bringing about the ceasefire, which was reached through Egyptian mediators on May the 21st. The comments by Washington's top diplomat are unlikely to satisfy human rights advocates who have repeatedly called on the U.S. to condemn Israel's actions against Gaza.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but the podcast links are not being updated. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. On to Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Brief reports on Shell Oil being forced to reduce carbon emissions. Germany and Norway are establishing shared renewable energy supplies. Bayer is trying to limit the future legal risk from the acquired product Roundup. Updates on COVID across the globe, and the European Union is planning sanctions against Belarus. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
And a court in the Netherlands has ordered oil company Royal Dutch Shell to reduce its carbon emissions by 45% by 2030. The case could set the stage for similar legal action against major energy firms around the world.
Now, it's known as the Green Link and aims to secure Germany's clean energy supplies for the future. A 600-kilometre cable connecting the energy grids of Germany and Norway has just been inaugurated. The mega project known as NordLink will enable surplus energy from German solar and wind farms to be used to satisfy Norwegian demand. Meanwhile, Norway's hydroelectric plants can now support Germany's grid when there isn't enough sun or wind to go around. The link is a key part of an energy transition plan by the German government. In addition to NordLink, four other energy routes are in the pipeline. They're intended to ensure there will be enough electricity to go around even once Germany has closed most of its nuclear, coal and gas-fired power plants. German chemicals maker Bayer says it will not increase the $2 billion it's put aside to deal with lawsuits over its Roundup weed killer. The company, however, says it'll review its plans to settle 30,000 separate claims. Bayer is trying to limit the future legal risk of the product, which claimants say causes cancer. The company says that the link is unproven. On Wednesday, a judge in the US rejected Bayer's proposal to offer compensation in exchange for limiting lawsuits.
In India, where the official COVID-19 death toll has passed 300,000, behind only the US and Brazil. Japan's opened its first mass vaccination centres 2 months before the start of the Olympics. Just 2% of the population is fully inoculated, significantly less than the US or many European countries. A new research in the UK has found that dogs can be trained to detect more than 90% of COVID-19 infections, even when patients are asymptomatic. In Taiwan, which has extended its nationwide warning level, currently at level 3, amid an ongoing spike in infections. The country has been battling an increase in infections after months of relative safety. The government says millions of vaccine doses will arrive in the country by the end of June. The Australian city of Melbourne has reintroduced COVID restrictions amid fears that a new cluster could grow into a major outbreak. Now, indoor mask wearing is being introduced and a travel bubble with New Zealand has been put on hold. And meanwhile, India has reported its lowest increase in daily cases since early April. Daily deaths are also down slightly. The country's been battling a severe second wave of the virus since April. EU foreign ministers have been meeting in Portugal to discuss further sanctions against Belarus. New sanctions are likely to target the country's potash exports as well as its oil and finance sectors. The bloc's already banned Belarusian airlines from EU skies. Germany's Heiko Maas said Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko must pay a high price for forcing a Ryanair plane to divert and land in order to arrest a dissident journalist.
We're discussing who should be added to the sanctions list. It won't be just individuals responsible for what's happened in recent days. We'll be targeting companies, too. The actions we've seen from Lukashenko in Belarus had a terroristic character. It was so unacceptable that we're not ruling anything out.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this listener-funded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support this freely distributed weekly radio show. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. The United States issued a maximum warning against traveling to Japan. South Korea has had its long-range missile development restrictions lifted by the U.S. An update on Myanmar. The Eiffel Tower in Paris has been lit up by carbon-free hydrogen fuel cells charged from renewable sources. NHK Japan.
We begin with a sign of growing international concern about the coronavirus situation in Japan. The U.S. State Department has issued a stronger warning against visiting the country. It raised its travel advisory for Japan on Monday by one notch to the highest level, urging Americans to avoid all travel to the country. The move reflects the latest update from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC says even those who are fully vaccinated may be at risk of contracting and spreading COVID-19 variants in Japan. Some international media are calling the move a fresh blow to a country struggling to convince its own public and the world that it's ready to host the Summer Olympics. They're scheduled to get underway in less than 2 months. Japan joins around 150 countries and territories that are subject to U.S. State Department Do Not Travel advisories. South Korea's presidential office has emphasized the importance of an agreement with the United States to lift restrictions on Seoul's missile development. The decision was agreed at last week's summit between President Moon Jae-in and his U.S. counterpart, Joe Biden. Previously, guidelines had restricted the range and payload of missiles that South Korea was allowed to develop. A presidential office official said Monday the new deal is proof that the two countries are equal partners sharing core values. Seoul agreed to the guidelines in 1979 in exchange for the transfer of U.S. missile technology. Despite a gradual easing of the restrictions, missile range had been capped at 800 kilometers until now. A South Korean Defense Ministry spokesperson said there has been no word from China on Seoul regaining the right to improve its missiles.
We don't think we have to take into account the impact on neighboring countries in taking this decision.
But local media said that Seoul's ability to make longer-range missiles may draw a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia.
We begin in Myanmar, where Aung San Suu Kyi has appeared in court in person for the first time since the military detained her and seized control of the country. The ensuing crackdown has killed hundreds, displaced thousands, and plunged Myanmar into chaos. Aung San Suu Kyi attended a court hearing on Monday in the capital, Naypyidaw. She faces several charges, including illegally importing walkie-talkie radios. She attended previous court hearings by video link. Her legal team spoke with her for half an hour before the closed-door proceedings. One of her lawyers said Aung San Suu Kyi looked fit and alert and smart as always. Aung San Suu Kyi told her team to tell the people she cares for them. The Electoral Commission appointed by the Myanmar military said last week it's considering dissolving the NLD. The Eiffel Tower in Paris has been lit up using a next-generation energy source, carbon-free renewable hydrogen. The iconic landmark was illuminated as part of an exhibition to showcase fuel cell technologies. A power generator using the same type of hydrogen fuel cell fitted in the Toyota Mirai car produced the electricity to light up the tower. The generator, with a maximum output of about 100 kilowatts, only emits water vapor.
Our number of hydrogen applications is growing quite dramatically. With everybody focusing on reducing emissions, there's clearly lots of opportunities there going forward.
Countries around the world are racing to develop hydrogen-related technology. France plans to invest more than $8 billion in the sector by 2030.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 9:30 to 10 p.m. at 7245 and 7355 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 25th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.